everyone, this is Philosophy of the People with Ben Burgess and Stephen Bertram, and I was maybe responsible, and I read the essay instead of like immediately beforehand, I read it last night, but that just led to me forgetting what my stupid anecdotes were meant to be. I was going to complain that whenever I try and make the stream go live, it's like, actually, do you want to do this in portrait mode? And I'm like, no. Like, but every time it's like, this would be better in portrait mode. It's like, why? It's like, no, just it'd be better, mate.
Fair enough.
But one thing I was going to say was, I didn't really, I only kind of realized it last night, even though we talked about kind of Marxist and logic before, and you kind of say in the essay that, yeah, for a while you didn't really connect them. But yeah, I was like, oh wait, Ben's kind of stuff about the liar paradox, which goes into non-contradiction or whatever, is actually kind of perfect for kind of the even though you didn't intend it that way, it's perfect for kind of the ways that Marxists engage with logic.
Yeah, certainly it connects to some things that some Marxists say about logic. So there are two things going on here. One is that there's something called dialectics, the dialectical method, dialectical analysis, or some people will tell you dialectical logic, that some Marxists have taken to be in conflict with classical logic, or at least in conflict with it, to the extent that Einsteinian physics is in conflict with Newtonian physics, which is to say that you could still on this view, this is like what Leon Trotsky, for example, says in his essay, The ABCs of Materialist Dialectics, that you could still think that one is a sort of good enough approximation for many practical purposes, but that the other is, the real thing. So that's one issue. But then, yeah, this is, sorry, just being amused by the chat. But then,
classical.
Yes, exactly. Then there's questions about how, there's like a different sort of set of problems you could have with classical logic, which just have to do with sort of paradoxes. So if I say this sentence that I'm saying right now is not true, then according to the law of excluded middle, it either is or isn't, but that would be a problem because if it is, it isn't. If it isn't, it is. And either way, that looks like it violates the law of non-contradiction, right? It says that nothing is both. And yeah, this is the stuff that when I was a graduate student, I was doing my academic research on. It's what my dissertation was on. And I have a book, which is not conveniently behind me, but
purchasable on Amazon.com.
Yeah. Well, anyway, whatever. It's not behind me. And it's called Logic Without Gaps or Gluts. That's an adaptation, basically, of the core argument from the dissertation. I make a comment in the essay, like the timing of which will never not be funny to me, because it came out the same week that I went on Joe Rogan. So that's the three most watched hours of my life, and the book that I wrote that the fewest people are ever going to read at the same time, because it's from an academic press, so it's very expensive, and it's about a obscure esoteric topic.
And I presume even in your case, like Phil yourself, if someone asked you to recommend one of your books to read, the group that you'd recommend that one would be a very small share of them.
Yes, correct. Yes. Yeah.
Now you might recommend it to me, but
yeah, Yeah, I might recommend it to you. But yeah, there'd be most people if they're just like, oh, I want to pick up any books, and like I have no particular information about them to make them me think they're in that group. That wouldn't be the one I would say.
Someone asked me on Reddit Ask Philosophy, can I recommend them a philosophy paper published in the past 50 years? And I was like, only in the sense that I could like recommend you a book out of the National Library.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, could they narrow it down a little bit more? That's the philosophy paper in the last 50 years. Like, is it a topic?
Yeah. Or any kind of
thing. Yeah, that would help. You know, I've gotten much better, but you know, I used to joke that, you know, I didn't have, you know, so yeah, don't ask me about anything before about 1969, you know, that's where I come in. But yeah, no, this is, so yeah, they, in that book, right, I'm talking about the second set of issues, that, you know, the issues about classical logic, from the perspective of thinking about, paradoxes, you know, semantic paradoxes like the liar, which is the one that I just mentioned, or, set theoretic paradoxes is the set, you know, of all sets that are not members themselves, a member of itself, all that stuff. And in so doing, right, the, you know, like my project in that, you know, the dissertation and the book very explicitly is to defend classical logic, to show that you can make sense of all of these things, you know, without having to give up either of those two principles that I mentioned, excluded middle or non-contradiction. But then, you know, depending on like which kind of sub-tradition you were reared in of how to think about, you know, dialectics, the dialectic, you know, whatever, you might think, well, hold up. This is silly. You're supposed to be a Marxist, and why would you want to defend classical logic, right? You know, why do you want to hold on to this kind of,
then you're a communist. Why do you want to defend like arithmetic?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's the clearly, yeah, right. Cause again, there is at least some tradition of, you know, seeing some sort of conflict there. And then, you know, so this is kind of where the, you know, the essay came out of. I mean, it's basically the transcript of a presentation I gave a couple weeks ago in Ann Arbor. I was there to do like a guest lecture for Matt McManus's citizenship and democracy class. And I did a Palestine talk for Detroit DSA and Wayne State YDSA. But while I was there, I went to, Matt's is in a Hegel reading group at U of M, which invited me to come talk to them about, they wanted me to talk about formal and dialectical logic. And, I suspect because of, you know, widespread suspicions that I'm a deviationist
you're kind of surface level socialist who doesn't really get it.
Yeah, never, you know, trapped in this kind of narrow minded analytic philosophy kind of way of doing things, and you know, can't appreciate the depths and subtlety of Hegelian dialectical logic.
I can put it close to the camera.
There you go. But yeah, so essentially like what I'm not doing in here, which would be interesting to do, and I've kind of tried to do just a teensy little bit in the two essays I wrote about this last year, is to sort of say, okay, like what is the correct way to think about dialectics or dialectical methodology or whatever we think that is. Should you just kind of say, there's nothing here that's really worth holding on to. or is it the, on the other end of the spectrum, do you actually think that there is this like unique methodology that you're just not going to get, if you don't express it in this kind of Hegelian language, or somewhere in between the two, could it be that this is a sort of, for historically specific reasons, this is a kind of idiom that people use to, kind of suggestive language that, comes with, that like is often used to suggest a certain set of insights that can ultimately be paraphrased, outside of that language, right? Which would, obviously I've kind of given it away in that tendentious way of setting it up that, that my sympathies lie right around number three, right? In that series, but I'm not trying to, I sort of gesture at that a little bit in the stuff I wrote about this last year. I should write something more in depth about that. But all I'm trying to do here is something much narrower, which is just to say, okay, look, if you think there's some sort of conflict between these two things, what is it? What could it be? Right? Given, I understand, if it's Hegel, I hesitate to make confident pronouncements about, anything that Hegel said, because people, because there's always like 20 extant interpretations of every sentence that ever came out of that guy's mouth. But certainly when you get to like Engels, right? Engels, I'm very confident that I understand what he's saying, right? So if you read the Anti-During, which is got to pause every time you mention this book to feel sorry for Herr During, that that it's been like it's been like a century and a half since anybody has thought about his name in any context other than the fact that there's a book called The Anti-During. But but in that book, right, there's this there's this chapter where Engels sort of lays out these principles of dialectical analysis, and those we can actually look at and sort of say, okay, well, what is he saying? And is there anything here that that would be in some sort of conflict with the principles of classical logic, such that we'd have to choose, even in the sense that like somebody like Trotsky thinks that we have to choose? Just to go ahead and spoil the ending, I think no, I don't see how. I ultimately do think this is like, this is a little bit like saying like, communists aren't allowed to believe in arithmetic.
Yeah. I did like this essay more than kind of the Trotsky one. Cause with the Trotsky one, I was like, well, you're just kind of being cranky and annoying and like, none of this makes sense. But sure. It was nice to go back and, talk about what Marx said and what Engels said to kind of see what the basis was and see if there was any basis. Because obviously, as you say, like stuff like the negation, if you take it and just kind of insert it formally right as that into logic, then yeah, that's a violation of some pretty important stuff. But if you take it in the context where it meant, and I think this is the most, not to skip ahead, as I always do, but I think the most important bit of your essay is where you point out in situations like negation and negation, what is happening there is specifically and exactly qualitatively different things. Like the negation, in Marx, very importantly, that this second negation is qualitatively different from the first one. And that's kind of very important that the bourgeois expropriation and the proletarian, the oncoming future proletarian expropriation, all qualitatively different things and specifically non-identical.
Yeah, exactly. So when you think, like out of the three principles that are, I don't know if principles is even the right word exactly, but whatever, out of the three things that Engels mentions.
The good useful rules.
Yes, out of the three good useful rules Engels mentions, the one that sounds most like logic-y, and hence, like, okay, maybe there is some sort of interest in, you know, clash here, is the negation of the negation, right? Because it uses the word negation, you know, which is a word that comes up a lot in, you know, actual, you know, logic. But it seems to be being used to mean very different things, right? So when you, like, the negation of a proposition is just, you know, not whatever the proposition is, right? So, and of course, anybody who knows, you know, a little bit of logic or even just kind of ordinary language, right, knows that in that sense, right, the propositional sense of negation, the negation of the negation just works out to the original thing, right? That the, that, you know, if I say, you know, if I put, you know, I mean, informal logic, if you have like a little Greek letter or something to represent a proposition, you put in two negation signs before it, right? Then those just cancel each other out, right? You could just derive the original Greek letter from it. Or again, I think we all kind of understand how that works on the level of ordinary language, that if, you know, you say something is not true, right, then it's true. And whereas, you know, if you start thinking, okay, well, what does Engels actually mean when he talks about the negation of the negation? One, it's not talking about propositions at all, right? And, you know, this is in fact supposed to be, you know, a method of analysis that applies to, you know, historical events, right? If it applies to anything, right? From a Marxist point of view, certainly. And second, the negation of the negation, as you say, does not take us back to the original thing, right? That like very crucially, it doesn't take us back to the original thing, right? Because this is any sort of, you know, if you want to talk about, you know, dialectical materialism, well, what is that, you know, or for that matter, like Hegelian, you know, dialectical idealism, right? Like, you know, what are these things theories of, right? These are theories of, you know, of historical progress. And, you know, and both of these are, you know, theories that postulate that, you know, progress is a thing that happens, right? You know, that things continue going forward, right? I mean, this is the sort of thing that, like, there are many types of, you know, academic distaste for Marxism that like, focus on precisely this fact about it.
It's historicist or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. That it's, you know, it's like, what are you, I mean, this is something I've had, you know, I've even seen, like, I don't know. I've even seen people who I basically like politically, who are trained in certain kinds of academic disciplines, who will sort of make a big deal of saying, you know, to be clear, I don't think there are laws of history. I was like, yeah, why not? Right? But, you know, what if there were? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's laws of physics, laws of biology.
Yeah.
All the mysteries, biological or physical, as in a non-organic physical thing.
Yeah. Like, you could, you know, yeah, why not? Right, come on. Like, you know.
They're probably just going to be impossibly vague.
You know, so.
The laws of history, shit happens. Things change.
Yeah. You know what, Silver? I think I did forget to post it there. My apologies. But in any case, yeah, and I do want to get to Kushluk's question, because yeah, I think that's more than a sentence, but just to get to through the basic point about the negation of the negation, in both the Hegelian and Marxist versions, right? I mean, this is, you know, you're talking about theories of historical progress, that, this is, yeah, that they have a, so given that, crucially, right, the negation of the negation doesn't take you back to the original thing. And so, you know, since I had, you know, as I was writing this, I think I'd just written the essay, or maybe I was still in the process of writing the essay about the Marx and Rawls versus Nozick and the land back left. So I was thinking about Capital, and this seems like, it's like, look, you want to know what Engels means by the negation of the negation. It seems like the sort of revolutionary conclusion of the primitive accumulation section of Capital shows you a really obvious example, maybe the most important example from Marx and Engels' perspective, which is that you have Marx talks about, you know, the negation of the property rights of peasants at the birth of capitalism, and then in turn, you know, says, look, this can't be, you know, this it's impossible and undesirable, right? Is this can't be turned back, but what we can do is go forward, you know, by expropriating the expropriators, that, you know, you can, you know, negate the negation of the you know, those original peasant property rights, not in the sense that we're going to, you know, figure out exactly where, you know, Stefan's ancestors, you know, had their hereditary rights to a little plot of land, so they can you can fulfill your lifelong dream of, you know, being a petty dirt farmer. But we can take the class of expropriators, and we can expropriate them, and we can create something better, right? Which seems like a really good indication that, you know, that what we're talking about here again is works in a just a fundamental, you know, we're talking about a fundamentally different kind of thing, right? Like, not, you know, I mean, both in the sort of obvious sense that, you know, we're not talking about propositions, we're talking about, you know, events, historical processes, but also that you know, that it's that negation in this sense doesn't seem to work at all in the same way, right, as propositional negation. This is just a different thing that, and this is like a different version of the same point that I was making way back in the very first book, the one, you know, one I'd be much more likely to recommend to people, give them an argument, because I do have a little chapter on this there, which is, you know, kind of funny actually. It's like anybody who overall liked the book, but this was the chapter that was the but, because this was like everybody, you know, because like the first few chapters are much more light and fun, and, you know, and this one, you know, it has truth tables in it. There's, you know, there's this stuff about you know, it's there's stuff about logic and dialectical logic, and, you know, and how they might relate to each other. And so the version of the point that I made way back there is like, look, if you just think about typical Marxist sentences that involve the word contradiction, pretty clearly we're talking about something very different from propositional contradictions. That, you know, if you're talking about a contradiction between class interests, or, you know, you're talking about, like, I don't know, capitalism being brought down by its internal contradictions or something like that, right? Like, these are clearly ways of using the word contradiction that, you know, there's like maybe the most distant possible analogy, but you're just using the word in a fundamentally different way. You know, this isn't a competing theory of the same subject matter, right? You know, this is just a different thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think, in common language, I think we would say, like, you know, something contradicts itself for something where, like, it has a self-facing flaw or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. Like, I think we do say that things are, or like we, yeah, I think we'll sort of use words about contradicting or inconsistency or things like that, where we're not actually talking about logical inconsistency. We're talking about like aspects of a thing that in some sense seem to point in, you know, in different directions, right? You know, that like where we're talking about people's personalities, you know, having surprising layers or whatever, right? Right? You know, we might even use the word contradiction to apply to that. And I think that's probably closer to the mark of what's actually, you know, meant by somebody like Ingalls, you know, when he uses terms like this, right? Like, I think that oftentimes I think uses of contradiction in, you know, Hegelian and Marxist traditions probably refer to things like they're just there being like an internal tension within a system or a setup, or something having different conditions for realization that can't actually all be realized at the same time. Or, you know, there being elements of a system that, you know, over time tend to undermine each other, you know, or something like that. Right. Like, and I think that in any, you know, so this is the thing that I don't really spell out in the essay itself. But, you know, in any of these cases, you know, I think that, you know, like the thing, you know, ultimately the work that needs to be done is just to say, okay, can we spell out in other language, you know, exactly what's being said, you know, when somebody says one of these things, right? Because there is, like, I do think the downside of, yeah, not so much like Ingalls, but like, you know, I think like more contemporary Marxists sometimes, the downside of the use of this language is that sometimes it does end up being a bit of a cheat code, right? Like, I think that, you know, I mean, surely you've met people who use the word dialectical in ways that make you suspect that at best it's just sort of a way of saying, I, you know, it's complicated, man.
Yeah, no, like it's a form of prayer.
Yeah, well, yeah. At worst, it's like a form of prayer, you know. But like, at best, it's just a sort of philosophically fancy way of saying that things are really complicated and hard to understand.
You need to remind me by naming your first book. You know, if you type in GTAA on YouTube, at least for someone who isn't like an owner of the GTAA YouTube, it comes up with like Grand Theft Auto 5 multiplayer games.
I'm not the least little bit surprised. yeah, no, it's, but yeah, the first book, was called, Give Them an Argument, Logic for the Left.
Yeah. I had something to say on the dialectics, but I forgot about it.
Did it break your brain?
Yeah. My brain has been hacked. I was just thinking about Heraclitus.
Okay.
Well, you were mentioning about kind of the laws of history, and very much a, you know, I think it is actually true that we never step in the same river twice. Like, even if you don't, yeah, even if we are suspicious of the kind of Marxist idea of kind of eternal progress or whatever, and if that's even a Marxist idea, Marxism, it's meant to end at some point. You know, even if we had cycles of capitalism and feudalism, they would all be different and unique, right?
Yeah, I mean, the right. I mean, presumably you don't have eternal progress if only because, you know, there's the heat death of the universe, right? That's
all right. Well, that's like... I do have a Marxist friend who does get annoyed about the heat death of the universe. So, can we not get past that, like?
Yeah. No, come on. Surely we'll come up with a technical fix sooner or later. I do know. I haven't actually read any of this. Maybe someday I will. But I, you know who Ted Grant is?
Not sure.
Okay, Ted Grant is, I don't even know if he's still alive or not, but he is or was a Marxist theoretician in the, you know, people, you know, the militant tendency of those people way back when. Right. And I think he, like, I think he had some sort of factional falling out with his former comrades in that tendency, because that happens, you know, but that's but in any case, I might be slandering the man here, right? Like, this is something I feel like I remember, so it's probably irresponsible to repeat it on YouTube, but I'll do it anyway. I believe that he wrote something that's like rejecting Big Bang cosmology for some sort of Marxist reasons that I don't know or understand, but this is, so, you know, maybe, you know, maybe this is the you know, maybe that's the
oh, that's what I was gonna say. Yeah, I was thinking about throughout that, the, I think it's the kind of the movement to being like, oh no, actually logic isn't real or whatever, is the same kind of move where just there's this massive concept creep going on with Marxist concepts, where kind of like Marx is saying, you know, I've got this theory which kind of shows the contradictions in bourgeois economics, which kind of undermines bourgeois economics. And then Marxists subsequently take this thing and massively concept creep it to say, like, it undermines bourgeois, just generally everything.
Yeah.
Or I mean, that, you know, some new theory comes along and they're like, actually, quantum physics proves that dialectical materialism is true about everything.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm, there are very few cases, I think, of philosophers who make comments about quantum physics that don't make me feel vaguely embarrassed, because, you know, I don't know enough to be sure that they're getting it wrong, but I have a
I think that just goes for everyone, right, that isn't a quantum physicist.
Extremely strong feeling that they're getting it wrong. Yeah, okay, somebody in the chat says, Kilgore Kraut says Grant died in 2004. Okay, 20 years ago. All right. Wow. Have you watched the Three Body Problem at all?
No, I haven't actually. I just saw it because it started a drama in Turkey, because they made one of the hero generals a woman from Yepyjer.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So I've only watched the first couple episodes, but the first one, the first scene of the first episode is set in China during the Cultural Revolution, and there's like a denunciation session of a physicist, you know, that has to do with the various ideological deviations from the like theories about physics that he holds, which the Grant thing, you know, really strongly reminds me of. But yeah, I guess I did see. Okay, so a while ago in the chat, I believe Kushluk.
I saved it.
Oh, you saved it. Okay, very good.
This one, right?
yeah. Exactly. Yeah, which the Marxist laws of history are correct. Yeah, look, I think it depends on how you're interpreting the claims, right? So in other words, you know, there are, just to be like tediously pedantic about this, right? You know, you have two questions, which are, one, what is historical materialism claim, and two, you know, is it true? And you know, I think just focusing for a second on the first one, whatever else it's supposed to be a theory of, it's certainly supposed to be a theory of how it is that modes of production rise and fall over time, that why it is that, you know, we used to have feudalism and now we don't, and we have capitalism instead, and, you know, inshallah, one day socialism, etc. Right. So, and, you know, there is an interesting interpretive question about, okay, is this the sort of thing that historical materialism is supposed to be a theory of, or is it also supposed to be a theory of like a bunch of other stuff too, right? Like a bunch of finer grained things about history. And I think the evidence is, a little bit mixed. And it also depends. I think oftentimes people who want to take it as a theory of something finer grained are maybe mixing up a little bit, like historical materialism per se, with some sort of broader concept of like class analysis. So what I mean by that is, you know, if you take the sort of canonical statement of historical materialism as what Marx says in the 1859 preface, which, you know, I would point out, you know, like there are a bunch of other things that he says earlier and later that make it seem like this is like a pretty consistently held view of his. I know that like there are some people, some like degrowth communist kind of people who have convinced themselves that later in life he gives up on it. But I'll just say I'm unswayed by the textual evidence for that.
People love to invent deathbed conversions. Yeah, or like useful truthers. Marx was based all the times he wasn't doing serious like written work.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's the what you got to do is like, you know, if he like jotted down a sentence on the back of a napkin once, then, you know, then that's definitely evidence that the thing that he spent like 20 years working out carefully, right, you know, was like no longer what he thought.
It's funny when young Marx destroys Stalinism when like all the stuff was published by the Soviets.
Yeah. Right. That's, I mean, I think like the economic and philosophical manuscripts of 1844 are interesting. I think there's a lot of good stuff in it, but I think that the idea that, that there's like this thing in there that sort of fundamentally contradicts the, like the, you know, economic determinism or whatever of the later stuff. Again, I'm very unswayed by the textual evidence for, but in any case, you know, I think that if you take that kind of 1859 stuff as the core of what historical materialism is supposed to be, then what, you know, what Marx basically says there are a couple things, right? So that, there's that the legal and political superstructure of a society is an effect of its economic base, you know, what the class relations are, and that the base in that sense, right, the class relations are an effect of the development of the forces of production. At least that's the part that's clearest. There's also some stuff about social being and social consciousness, which is very, you know, which is very suggestive, but it's also like a little bit less clear what that means. Right. And, you know, and if you really want to sort of, if you really want to go nuts with the implications here, I guess that would be the part that you'd want to seize, you know, seize hold of. Cause it's like, okay, what does it mean? You know, social being determines social consciousness. Does that mean like everything, right? That so, you know, class analysis is going to tell you why the last Marvel movie had the plot that it did, and, you know, and why you know, who's going to win Eurovision, and like or, you know, or some sort of interesting and significant subset of everything. But I think the core claims about forces of production, relations of production, and legal and political superstructure, yeah, I think that stuff is mostly true, right? Like, I think that that's, you know, you can sort of allow a reasonable amount of room for historical contingency and still say, yeah, this does actually seem like a very good explanation of why it is that we have the kinds of institutions that we have in the world today, and why we used to have different ones, and, you know, why one day we might have still other ones, and so on, right? You know, that, that, you know, saying, you know, there does seem to be a, you know, I mean, on the face of it, there sure seems to be a connection between the transition from primitive communism to sort of directly extractive early class societies and the agricultural revolution. And there similarly seems to be a connection between the, you know, between the transition between feudalism and capitalism and the industrial revolution, that that those things seem to be very intimately related to each other. I think that there's some a priori reason to suspect that if one system does a better job of facilitating the development of the forces of production than another system, that it's good that the system that does a better job is going to expand. It's going to, you know, it's
on the free marketplace of modes of production.
Yes, exactly. It'll win out in the free market of modes of production. Yeah. Like, you know, if nothing else, you'll have, you know, better, you know, if you're better at further developing the forces of production, if nothing else, you'll probably have better military technology and you'll be better able to win wars. Right. So that alone is going to give you some kind of edge. There's, you know, surely, you know, a large part of the transition from primitive communism to early class societies takes place through like conquest and enslavement, you know, of primitive communist tribes. That's certainly a big one. And, you know, and obviously that also plays a big role in transition to capitalism. I think that the, I think just sort of power of example causes a lot of emulation, right? You know, that you have, you know, if you're the, you know, if you're like a Scottish lord, you know, who sees all of these people who are making all this money by becoming, you know, by basically, you know, turning themselves into modern capitalists, that'll give you ideas and say, oh, if we could just get rid of all these fucking peasants, we could, you know, we have all this land here that I'll bet I could actually make a lot of money off of as a sheep pasture.
I thought you meant you when you mentioned a Scottish lord.
You know, that's so like that kind of power of emulation, right? You know, does it. So I think there are like a bunch of plausible mechanisms that mean that it would be the case that a system that does a better job of developing the force of production is going to have a, you know, various kinds of edge over competing systems. And I also think that it's extremely plausible that, you know, legal and political institutions will tend to rearrange themselves around however, you know, production is happening at the base of society, right? That's the, however, the thing that's the way that everybody meets their material needs and how everybody spends most of their days and all that stuff is going to tend to exert this gravitational pull over other kinds of social institutions to make it, you know, come into line with it, right? I mean, like if, you know, during the transition from feudalism to capitalism, the, like you had all these, like old guild rules that, you know, you weren't, you know, the guild master could only have a certain number of apprentices that, you know, would basically make factories impossible because, you know, because that would be too many apprentices. And, you know, and I think for obvious reasons in a situation like, and like that, there's incredibly strong incentives by a lot of different players in the system to pretend the law doesn't exist until it can be ignored, until it can be actually overturned. And similarly for laws that stopped, that stopped peasants from leaving their land, to go get jobs at said factories, et cetera. Right. Like I think that there is this incredibly powerful gravitational effect of this. And, you know, I think it can happen in a lot of different ways. Right. I mean, this is the, you know, that you can have like, you know, like certainly if you read that final section of Capital on Primitive Accumulation, I mean, Marx is describing a process that's playing out over the course of several centuries. But, you know, it has leap, you know, there are points where it happens really quickly and points where it happens really slowly. And you have actual revolutions, and you also just have sort of gradual processes that, you know, you might even keep the same institutions, right? You people embarrassingly have a lot of your feudal, pageantry still in place.
And also, like, there's a full county owned by the king. Like, he owns all the land there. Like, so it's not just a pageantry. It's like a lot more than the pageantry.
Yeah, it's a lot more than the pageantry, but it's a lot less than what existed several hundred years ago.
Yeah, we are in fact a capitalist country.
Yes, exactly, right.
We're declining so much that soon enough,
Maybe not forever, but yeah, no, like that they have that over the course of, over the course of time, right, the sort of ways that legal rights and duties and obligations like work themselves out, that you end up having, essentially for most purposes, right, most of the legal and political superstructure in the UK for all that it matters for most day-to-day purposes isn't really that different than it is in like France.
Yeah, and obviously the king in his royal estate managed this land as a capitalist, not as a feudalist.
Right. Yeah, right, exactly, right. He isn't, Charles isn't... taking trips to his county to settle legal disputes, and raise armies to defend it against bandits and, all of that stuff, as amazing as it would be. Did you see that in Canada, they just, speaking of embarrassing, they just
voted God Save the King.
Yeah, they just voted down a bill that would have made the oath of loyalty to King Charles optional.
I mean, to be honest, it shouldn't be optional, right? Either you should have it or you shouldn't have it. Like, it's embarrassing to have a loyalty oath that's optional. Like, it's just a ridiculous idea.
Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, I wouldn't have said God Save the King, but...
would have voted against it, yeah. I don't know, man. I think that you can... I think if you're...
fucking reformist.
I think if you're making people... If you're making people take an oath of loyalty to the king in 2024, I mean, this is like, you've really got to take stock. And, as I said, I saw that. I love my many Canadian friends, but you guys really need to get your shit together.
In the UK, the army officers have to take an oath of loyalty, but naval officers don't, because it's just, it goes with territory. Of course they are, I wasn't paying attention 100% for the past while, because I was trying to work out the Trotskyite abolition of the Big Bang thing. And so, yes, you were correct that Ted Grand wrote a book, Reason in Revolt, where he rejected Big Bang cosmology. But what's more notable is that this theory is continually defended to this day by IMT, the International Marxist Tendency.
Awesome.
I found one article from 2005 defending it, but also there's an article, a brand new-ish article, just from last year. Basically, whenever there's some kind of evidence which isn't in line with the Big Bang model of cosmology, they drop a new article being like, Ted Grant was so right, guys. So recently, evidence has come out from the James Webb Telescope that galaxy formation happened much earlier than we would have thought.
Okay.
And so they've just dropped another article being like, yeah, it's not real. Didn't happen. There was no Big Bang. They seem offended by the idea that the Big Bang is like creation ex nihilo. The only way, we have to believe that there's like eternal, when you go back and forth between a Big Bang and a Big Crunch, I've forgotten the term, but.
Oscillations.
Yeah, maybe. But it's interesting because I was thinking recently that I feel like Catholics and the Catholic Church didn't get as hyped as they should have with the Big Bang. Because in some ways, it was literally like, and then there was light.
Yeah, no, true. This is, I mean, look, I actually think that this is historically, this is something that's like, it reflects well on, you know, atheist and agnostic physicists for running with it, because it's,
and we had to wait until Trotskyism, right? British Trotskyism of the later 20th century, for it to be rejected on like an ideological basis.
Yeah, exactly. This is, well, the although I do really like the essay that came out today, you know, we're as of now, we're, you know, approximately a week behind because there wasn't an essay last week, because I just did the announcement for the new Capital class. Yes, I do. So that is starting on May 12th. So I guess about four Sundays hence. And it's going to be on Zoom from 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern time.
And then you can come watch this.
And then you can come watch this. Exactly. Yeah, this is, yeah, we'd started doing it like way back when, actually before, you know, yeah. So when I did the first round Capital class, I was doing it at that time slot, 'cause it seems like the thing that works out best for most people. I mean, if you're, you know, if you're in Taipei or something, you might be screwed, but if, there's a very wide range of time zones you'll be okay in, right? 'Cause that's, you know, 1 EST is, you know, 10 a.m. in Los Angeles, 7 p.m. in Berlin, you know, so it's, you know, there's it's like a reasonable time on a day that almost everybody has off for most people, if you want to take that. And so, yeah, when we did it before, we just read volume one, but
this, for the next, you know, figure couple this years time, we'll be reading volume one, but then there's a plan to eventually.
Yeah, exactly. That's 33 chapters, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a couple of years this time. Kind of was last time, but but yeah, this time there's a plan to be fanatically completist about it and to go through all three volumes. So yeah, that's, you know, go over to patreon.com/BenBurgess if you want to sign up for the class. I'm actually really looking forward to that. I've been like, it's been a little while. I'm trying to think how long it's been since round one ended, but it's been quite some time.
I think we were definitely contemporaries with this, but it ended a while ago. So
yeah, yeah, that seems right. Cause it was still going when we were starting this, but I don't think it was still going for long.
It was done by June or something last year.
Yeah, that seems right. So yeah, it's been almost a year. And honestly, I miss it. It's for me, you know, since it's 10 a.m. for me, like having that Sunday morning, spending a couple hours talking about Capital is actually a really nice way to start Sunday. So yeah, I am definitely looking forward to that. And yeah, eventually I do want to do, you know, so if you sign up for the class, the Zoom recordings of those will be available for people who are in the class. People ask about YouTube. I do eventually want to do like a version of this that'll make its way onto YouTube. Like, you know, in a classroom, David Harvey style, do like a nice, like high production values kind of Capital series, but I'm not quite sure when that'll happen. So meanwhile, anybody who wants to read some Capital, sign up for this, you know, get the, then yeah, have a nice, can take an hour off, you know, go for a walk, have some coffee, come back and go to YouTube and watch us talk about philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah, I was like, wait, should I go? And I'm like, no, because I wanna have my facilities for this, especially since presumably Ben will have a bit less facilities.
Fair enough. Yeah.
I should read volume 2 and 3. But right now I wanna read Nick Land.
Interesting. Yeah. I don't know, man. I think there are just a few things I'm sure of in this life, but one of them is Marx greater than sign Nick Land.
But did Marx predict that in the 2020s lots of people wouldn't be able to come?
He would have. Because that would have been a Capital Volume 5.
If he'd written in the 1990s, yeah. Because Nick Land was like writing in the 1990s where everyone could come, saying that in the future people wouldn't be able to come. And now everyone is SSRI and trans, which means they can't come.
Sure. This is definitely a series of straightforwardly true statements that we just heard.
It is. It's really funny because it's 90% nonsense. And then 10% is like, how the fuck did you predict that?
Fair enough. That almost makes me want to read Nick Land. I think Capital Volume 1 is obviously a masterpiece in a way that 2 and 3 aren't.
Where's the bit about like surface workers and kitchens and stuff? Is that in 3 or 2?
2.
Okay.
Yeah, 2, right? Because that's the...
Because, I mean, that feels like stuff that, you know...
No, that's the thing. So it's like there are, even though, right, I mean, let's be real clear on this, right? Volume 1 is the one that he got Marx got exactly the way he liked it, and it shows, right? Like it has, that's where you've got all of the it's really well structured, and you have all the allusions to Shakespeare and the Bible and Dante, and the every chapter ending is a banger, even for pretty dry chapters. Whereas volumes 2 and 3 are, Marx while dying, says, Hey, Engels, here are some notebooks, do what you can with these. And, this is, and so it's not like that. Right. So it's like volume 1 is a pleasure in a way that the others aren't, but I still think 2 and 3 are worth reading because they've got stuff in there that are
like an abridged edition for a contemporary audience, you'd certainly want to include the stuff about service workers.
So I mean, they have the stuff where he's talking about productive and unproductive labor, that's definitely important. There's actually some 2 in particular is pretty dry for the most part, but then 3, structurally it's a little bit more of a mess, but it's like, it's got the, it just kind of ends, right? Like very abruptly, but Rick. That's where, some of that stuff about like the realm of work and the realm of freedom and all that, I'm sure you've seen quoted, comes from. That's where like probably the most direct, some of the most direct arguments about value and prices come in. And so it's definitely all interesting and worth reading if you want to be fanatically completist about it. Obviously if you just there's only so much time and you just want to, you have to save time to read, Nick Land, make predictions about coming, you can only take in so much capital. You've only got 1,000 pages or so in you, just read volume 1.
Yeah. I mean, and don't get scared of it. Like, it's not that hard. People really hype it up, and it's not that hard. And, some of it are hard to understand, but it's not really like, if you don't, like, Marx gives lots of examples. So even if you're not really clear on like the theoretical bits, if you didn't really get it, you can read the examples and at least get the general impression of what the point is.
Yeah, exactly. And I should say too, people always get, like a lot of people start capital reading groups and around chapter three, they give up. And I get it.
You're not going to make people read it in your verse or edited edition.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. We'll be fanatically completist about it. We will read it in the original order, but like, honestly, this is just one of those things where you got to keep the faith, because if, you know, you're starting to read in, you know, actually the end of chapter one is really good, if you start to read chapter one and you've got, there are all of these examples about yards of linen, and what 20 yards of linen are an argument equivalent to, and you get into, you know, and then, yeah, you get like, by the time you get through like all the stuff about money and, you know, so I mean, Marx himself has this phrase, you know, about the metaphysical subtleties and theological niceties of commodities and money, which is what the first three chapters are about. And a lot of that stuff is like people just sort of, you know, they get bored or they think, I don't understand anything that's going on here. I'm not smart enough.
TikToks in this book.
Yeah, they just stop reading, right? But honestly, even in chapter four, it's already getting better. And by the time you get to chapter six, it's actually honestly riveting, right? Because that's where the class analysis starts. And, you know, it's like, again, it's just one of the, like, you just kind of have to take it on faith that this is not a book this is not 33 chapters on how money works and, you know, how many yards of linen are equivalent to, you know, how many years of corn. This is by and large a book that's about the idea that capitalism is ultimately a class society, like the way feudalism is, but it works in a different way. How it is that working hours are extracted from workers by capitalists, how it's, you know, similar to and different from earlier modes of production, you know, how the system reproduces itself, why a lot of the ways that people who have various kinds of utopian schemes for you know, making capitalism but not so bad are missing the point, right? Like, I mean, I think the most plausible, you know, people get very a lot of people sort of approach those first three chapters in a way that's very I don't know. It's very like Talmudic, right? You know, as they're sort of parsing exact turns of phrase and, you know, sentence by sentence to, you know, and I think oftentimes miss the larger point, right? And I think the most plausible view I've seen of like what's really going on in those first few chapters is that Marx is ultimately pushing back against various kinds of utopian socialist weirdos who have whose analysis of what's wrong with capitalism is that like money is bad.
There's also an important attack on kind of like money fetishism, which is a very, very common thing, especially mm-hmm. at a time when they were on the gold standard.
Yeah, totally. Right. And the thing, you know, and so it's like, I think part of the underlying agenda is to say, look, if you do your scheme for like, oh, we're not going to have money anymore, we'll just have, you know, we'll have, you know, special certificates, you know, that we'll exchange or whatever. Bucks. Yeah. That a lot of the, I think a lot of the point he's actually making in those early chapters is this all just totally misses the point, right? This isn't going to help with anything because look, money isn't something special, that, you know, gold is the money commodity. It's still just a commodity, that ultimately it's, you know, you're still just exchanging one amount of a commodity for, you know, for some amount of another commodity. And, you know, the, you know, you could theoretically have a version of capitalism where you just, you know, where you didn't have a universal equivalent, you just bartered. It'd be incredibly inefficient, right? But, and there's a reason we don't, right? You know, but like, and you could sort of theoretically, you know, you could theoretically imagine something like that, you know, happening. And, you know, and he's, you know, and Marx is building an argument over the course of the book that says, you know, look, it's not that there's something special about money. It's not that there's, it's not just that, like, you know, it's not about sort of intrusions into the market, right? I mean, that they, that like you have, that, oh, the problem at the most fundamental level is not that the capitalists like rig the game, you know,
but right. I mean, he's portraying capitalism as like an idealized version of capitalism, like if everything was going perfectly.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So he's saying, you know, for most of the book, he's making all kinds of idealizing assumptions. He's saying, look, let's just pretend for the sake of, like, you know, there's quite a bit of the book that's spent talking about working hours and, you know, how it is that, you know, that ultimately, you know, ultimately you're spending a certain number of hours of the day working to reproduce your own livelihood, and then like a certain number of hours of the day to, you know, to enrich the boss. And he says, and he does even make a comment at one point. He's like, look, I understand that one strategy that actually existing capitalists use is just to try to like drive wages down below the historically determined standard of living. Like, I get that. Right. That's obviously a thing that happens, but I'm going to pretend for the sake of argument and all this that it doesn't happen. Right.
Yeah.
That,
I mean, you couldn't keep doing it forever. Right.
Yeah. That's also true. But yeah, it's like they, so it's like, you know, so a lot of the argument of the book is like, look, let's pretend, right, that there's no force or fraud, that labor is always being purchased at its value. That in other words, and he has like this very specific, very clever way of doing that, that they have you know, given his theory of what value is and all that. So this is, you know, like the working days of workers are always being purchased at their value. So nobody's being cheated in any way, right? It's not that like the rules of market fairness just aren't being, you know, followed. It's just that you only need two assumptions, right? One is that you have some people, as a matter of fact, who have the resources that it takes to own the means of production and employ others. And you have people who, as a matter of fact, however it came about, do not have the resources to go into business for themselves, so have no realistic choice except to rent themselves out to the first group. So, you know, you have that distribution and you have markets, and that's it. That's all you need. Right, that given those assumptions, capitalism is still going to be a class system, an exploitative system, the way that slavery and feudalism were, and that's like a big overarching argument that he's working out, you know, throughout the book. Right, I mean, that's why the primitive accumulation stuff only comes in part eight, because he even says pretty explicitly, I want to say in like chapter 20 something, anyway, it's in the 20s. He's sort of going over the exploitation argument again from a slightly different angle than he did earlier in the book. And, you know, and he says, okay, you can have, you can assume that workers, like, let's assume for the sake of argument that the capitalist, you know, just use only legitimate means to get their initial operating funds. It's the variable capital fund. In other words, the part of their profits they're using to pay, you know, the part of the revenues of the firm they're using to pay workers' wages. Let's assume they got it from only legitimate means. Perhaps he even says we could assume that the capitalists, you know, themselves was a worker who just did a really good job of saving up money, you know, for a long time. Nevertheless, it wouldn't matter because over the course of time, workers are, you know, even if the first tank of gas in the variable capital fund is filled by the capitalists from some other mechanism, the workers themselves are constantly refilling it over the course of time, right? So that's so.
You know, yeah, I mean, otherwise, why did you invest in this factory if you would have had to do the same thing you did anyway before you invested? Yeah,
totally, right? You know, so yeah, so he's making like all these limited
assumptions. Just because they love to grind.
You wouldn't understand because you don't have the grind set. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it's like that you have, so like in arguing against both, you know, bourgeois economists, you know, Smith, Ricardo, and all those people, but also, you know, various kinds of, you know, various kinds of utopian socialists who he thinks missed the point about how, or, you know, Pradhanian mutualists or whoever, who he thinks missed the point about how capitalism actually works and what's wrong with it. You know, he's building this overall argument over the course of the book that, you know, this is, you know, that, yeah, one, like a lot of what he's slamming the bourgeois economists for over the course of the book is treating like historically specific features of capitalism as just like eternal natural features of any sort of production process ever. But
it's pretty funny when it has been going on for like 80 years when he was writing.
Yeah, that's also very true. Yeah, very fresh at that time. Yeah, everybody. Yeah, everything was, you know, yeah, all the, yeah, everything was basically brand new. Everybody, you know, like everybody was just, like, you know, yeah, every.
I mean, it's true today that people are like, things have to be this way and there's no alternative to something that came into being like 7 years ago.
Yeah.
Like you need an internet enabled phone or you
Yeah, I was just going to try to come up with some sort of callback about how back then everybody could definitely still come. But, it's, you know, just look at how many children they had. But yeah, but then also, again, you know, that the thing that's wrong with capitalism is not, you know, something about money or something about the way that, you know, capitalists like work the refs to get the state to do this or that for them, or anything like that, that, you know, that just given that, you know, get just given some people having the assets they do, some people not having those assets, just markets doing their thing, will do the rest. Right. So that's, and yeah, it's a really, anyway, look, it's, I think that if nothing else, you know, if nothing else, I think that it's a, you know, I mean, it's worth reading it just to have read it, to have like, as you say, a lot of people sort of end up being intimidated by it. And, you know, the chapter order definitely doesn't help because, the stuff at the beginning is the least accessible stuff in the book. But it gets so much better, right? You know, from chapter six onwards.
Especially you sound like a good read reviewer of like a mediocre fantasy novel.
You know, but it's also yeah, I mean I think that you know I think if you're interested in talking and thinking about Marxism, and if you're not, I don't know why you're watching us right now, you know, cause surely your Sunday afternoon doesn't need to be spent watching a video with word dialectics in it. Nobody's making you do this. So you probably are interested in Marxism. So if you are interested in this, then it's like, look, this is the book. Right. You know, you should, you know, if there's one book that's the book, you know, for Marxism, this would be it. So you should read it. So you'll have better informed opinions and you'll get a lot out of it. And a lot of it's a lot of fun.
Have you heard of the video game Victoria 3?
No, I have not.
Victoria 3 is a video game, a grand strategy game, where you take a country in 1836 and you play them until 1936. And the point basically is to transition them from a feudal economy to a capitalist economy. And it's actually funny because it's kind of, in the current state of the game, I would say it's a more Marxist game than reality is.
Yeah.
In a strict orthodox sense, because in the game, India will like industrialize and progress under British imperialism, despite that obviously not being something that happened in reality. But in the next patch, they're basically adding Marxist-Leninism to the Marxism. They're patching in Leninism, which basically allowing foreign investment and meaning that owners don't have to live in the same state as the things they own. So I'm looking forward to Victoria 3 adding in Leninism. It's a game I played multiplayer with Gene. Well, you just reminded me earlier when you were talking about gold, because I was playing Mexico, and obviously as Mexico, you have a big problem, and that problem is called the United States.
Right.
But I managed to hold on long enough to start exploiting the gold in California and so on. And so basically my country became like 50% of the population works in gold mines and gold-related industries, and the other half just have a gun. And then every 5 years we fight an apocalyptic war with the United States to defend our gold. But I was reminded because Victoria 3 does have this kind of gold fetishism where gold, the money commodity, is the only thing which doesn't vary in price or value. Okay. It just has a fixed value, just stays as it is. So it's not perfectly Marxist, but it's as best as you're going to get.
Fair enough. I don't know. I think I might not have, never played a video game more contemporary than Mario Kart, but.
not exactly grand strategy, Marxist, capitalist, feudal transition games.
Yeah, but that does actually sound kind of fun. I'm officially intrigued.
No, it was fun. I remember talking to Ashley about it, and she was like, "Oh, I should play the game." And she's like, "Oh no, I shouldn't. I should watch you or Gene play that game." So yeah, eventually, me and Gene will stream it on TIR, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I need to learn how to work on OBS because it lags really bad on restream.
Yeah, HG. Be really funny if I did like game streams, but only for like games that I was already like familiar with. So it would mostly just be me like playing Ms. Pac-Man.
I'm looking forward to, we should get a stream with you and Ashley and me and Gene, and you two can just not play the game. And be like, look, it's just like Marxism.
There we go. Yeah.
As I build a fucking linen factory.
The equivalent of the, I remember this old Hannibal Buress joke about where he's like making fun of the way that, you know, some rappers would, not just like do little samples from other musicians, but just like play like a bunch of it and like just be like, and just like occasionally add, oh yeah, that's right, and so to like make fun of it, he played this like old Chris Rock bit for like 5 minutes, part of his set. And all he was like, yeah, good point.
He's so right.
Ashley and I could contribute in that vein.
What's next week?
Well, if we were, we could decide, of course, whether we're going to continue to be a week behind or catch up. If we do continue to be a week behind, it's going to be an essay called Richard Dawkins' Nonsense Makes Me Miss the Not Quite New Atheism of Quentin Smith. If we decide to catch up to the present day, we'll see.
Ah, there hasn't been a choice. It's lucky dip for me. It's my immense powers of being like, oh yeah, that's too long.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, goodbye, everyone.